So good afternoon, everyone. How are you all doing today? Yes, everyone's good? Everyone's happy? Excellent. Very good. No one's suffering? No? They're not suffering. Well, and obviously the Buddha was wrong, so we should all go home. Thanks, Dennis. Okay. So, welcome, I'm Bhante Sujata, and this, of course, is Venerable Brahmali, and we will be presenting to you the number 4 workshop in the series on karma and rebirth in early Buddhism. And just to briefly recap where we've come so far, we've looked at, in the first workshop, we looked at we did some myth-busting, looked at commonly held ideas about how karma and rebirth work, and we showed that most of those ideas are not really confirmed by what the Buddha taught, and generally speaking, anyway, in my point of view, how the Buddha taught it was eminently more sensible than many of the myths that we hear about karma and rebirth. In the second workshop, we looked at the historical context to look at how these ideas came about, what they meant, the imagery, the metaphors, the meaning of those ideas in the time and place of the Buddha. In the third workshop, last workshop we did, we looked more in detail at the actual texts, the suttas taught by the Buddha on karma and rebirth, and we tried to do a survey of the main core teachings on karma and rebirth as found in the early Buddhist texts. And for this workshop, we're now going to take up one of the themes which we found very predominantly in those texts, and that theme is that you should investigate, you should inquire, you should find out for yourself. And so this is one of the things which is most characteristic of the Buddha's teachings. Huh? And when we recite the recollection of the Dhamma, ehipassiko, come and see, investigate it for yourself. It's one of the fundamental characteristics of the Dhamma. And so it's very important that rather than just taking things for granted, that we look and say, is this really true? Is this evidence right? Is it correct? Now, I talked this same workshop a week ago in Sydney at the Buddhist Library, and one of the videos which I showed then was of a little girl in Yorkshire called Nicola, who seemed to be able to remember her past lives. And after seeing that, one of the ladies who was in the course, named Barbara, who's studied history and so on, and she thought there were a couple of anomalies in the story that was presented, and she very interestingly went back and did the actual research, looked in the historical records, births and deaths in that town in England, and so on and so forth, and she found out that actually not all of the events in that story added up. People who were born, there weren't people of those names and place and times born in that place. And so that throws a question mark over that story. So we won't be showing that video for you today because I'm no longer confident that it's a reliable story. And that is very excellent. I was so happy and so pleased to see one of the students actually doing that, actually investigating and finding out. You can, if you're interested to know about that, you can read on the discourse.suttacentral.net, which is what we're using for our discussion forum for this course. So any discussion, materials, slideshows, videos, and so on about the course, you can all find on discourse.suttacentral.net. So for this workshop, this is our question, to look at the evidence. We know that the karma and rebirth is something which is taught by the Buddha, but is it true? Maybe the Buddha was wrong. Right? I don't know, maybe my head is going to be split into 7 pieces by Saka wielding his thunderbolt above me for saying such a thing. But the Buddha never said that there was anything wrong in questioning him. On the contrary, he actually encouraged the monks to question his ideas. And in fact, he gave long and detailed discourses outlining exactly how he should be questioned and tested. And so it's in that spirit that we're coming along and we want to test these things. And so we're going to be looking at what is the evidence for karma, what is the evidence for rebirth, what different kinds of evidence they are, how solid and reliable they are, and whether we find them persuasive or not persuasive, and what the meaning of different kinds of evidence is. there's a lot of ground to cover in this workshop, and we've assembled a lot of different kinds of resources and so on. So hopefully we'll be able to cover, do a general survey. But if you are interested, there is a lot more to be found. Oh, yeah. So who's this? Who's that? Ah, very good. People have done their homework. Excellent. Professor Ian Stevenson. Yeah, so he's the man who's done perhaps more than any other detailed and very careful work into researching questions of past lives, and in particular the memories of young children in their past lives. And he's actually opened up one of his innovative fields that he opened up was the link between reincarnation and biology, where children are reborn with biological marks that seem to relate to events that happened in the previous life. And we'll be looking at a couple of those cases a little bit later on this afternoon. And so he was put there, I think, as a really good example of somebody who has really done that inquiry and established the evidence. Okay. So just to begin, just a very brief kind of summary, why are we looking for evidence? Okay, we've seen in the earlier workshops that the question of rebirth is important. It matters. Is it true or is it not true? Well, that's what we need to decide. But either way, I think it matters. And it matters whether is this life our only life or does something happen to us after death? And if something does happen to us after death, is that going to be good or bad? What affects that? What are the conditions for that? I think these are important questions. They're questions that are addressed in every religion and philosophy. Many wise people over the years have discussed them and treated them at length. And I think it's important that we should give some consideration for them. And I also think it's important we shouldn't just take it for granted. I'm a Buddhist, therefore I believe in this. We should be able to question these things. Research and Dhamma should Research and Dhamma should support each other. So rather than thinking that sort of evidence is something which is either going to prove or disprove the Dhamma, evidence is something which will help us to understand the Dhamma better. Okay, and so evidence can never disprove the Dhamma. The Dhamma is just the way things are. It's the truth of things are. What it can disprove is our own mistaken conceptions about the Dhamma, our own misunderstandings of what the truth really is. And so the more that we establish, investigate the truth of things through research, the stronger our faith in the Dhamma becomes. And this is actually one of the teachings which you find in the early suttas, and the Buddha gives different kinds of mental qualities and the antidote for these mental qualities. And this is a very interesting one because often these antidotes are things that you would expect. So the antidote for laziness is energy. The antidote for distraction is calm, and so on and so forth. But the antidote for doubt, right? You'd think the antidote for doubt would be faith. Yeah? But what it actually says is the antidote for doubt is inquiry. Yeah? So you don't overcome your doubts by saying, I'm going to be more faithful. You overcome your doubts by asking and inquiring. And so that's what we're going to be doing here. And if we want to inquire, we want to find out the truth, the basic way of investigating that the suttas talk about is to use empirical research. And by empirical research, what we mean is research which remains close to the evidence of the senses. Okay? So it's not research which is based on metaphysical premises. It's evidence which looks at the facts, tries to examine and find out what is the reality, what's going on, and then tries to look at what can we infer from that. What does that mean? What are the implications of that? And so this is that method which we find taught again and again and again throughout the suttas, and it's applied in a somewhat different way in scientific method. It's a different field, a different purpose, but the basic idea is very similar. Okay, anything to say on that? Sorry? Yep. Okay. Do you want to talk to this one?
Yeah.
Okay, there we are. So this is about a very famous, quite famous anthropologist called Gamanad Obeyasekara, He was originally a man, he was from Sri Lanka, born in Sri Lanka, and later on he became quite famous for his anthropological research. And he worked with Richard Gombrich, the professor at Oxford University of Sanskrit, and later on he became a professor at Princeton University in the United States. So he was very accomplished in his field. But of course what was interesting about him is that not only was he accomplished, but it's actually the particular field that he was researching. And one of the fields that he researched, and he wrote a whole book about this, is comparative beliefs in rebirth around the world. And we actually have a book about this. Maybe I'll bring that for us right away. We brought a bunch of books to this course, that you can have a look at the kind of books that are available from a more scientific kind of perspective on these things. And this is this book by Gananath Obasekera, Karma and Rebirth, a cross-cultural study here. And what he found, this man who was very accomplished and it's quite a highly acclaimed book, is that the idea of rebirth, the belief in rebirth, is actually quite widespread around the world. And he looks at different cultures and where this exists. Obviously the kind of basic cultures is India, right? You have the Hindus and the Buddhists in India. And then, of course, you have the Greek world. It's quite well known that the Greeks also had an idea of rebirth. Plato had a rebirth, idea of rebirth. Pythagoras and many of the other ancient Greeks had this, accepted this idea. Socrates seemed to have very clearly, we'll have a look at that afterwards, idea of rebirth. So even the founding father, right, of Western philosophy basically believed in rebirth, which is quite interesting here. And then he showed, but it's not only in these two very kind of central cultures for world civilization, right, India on the one hand, and the kind of founding culture of European culture on the other, but also around the world in many different places that you find that belief in reincarnation or rebirth existing. And for example, in North America it exists, among the Indian, the ancient Indian cultures in North America, among the Inuits that live all the way up to the polar circle. It exists in Africa, in many different tribes in Africa it exists, and it also exists among some of the Pacific Islanders as well. So you can see that's a pretty good spread, right? I mean, you're pretty much covering the whole globe there. And these were just the cultures that he was investigating, and it's quite likely that it exists in other cultures as well. Now what he found is that this general idea of rebirth exists there. However, the understanding of rebirth is a little bit different. So for example, in some of these cultures, they just have this very simple idea that you get reborn back into the family, or you passed away, right? It's just a kind of human-to-human rebirth. In some of other ones, they also have the idea of being reincarnated as animals. For example, the North American cultures, also the idea that you get reborn as animals. So again, the main point is perhaps not so much that there are differences here. The main point is that this is a cross-cultural phenomenon, right? And this, of course, throws up some questions. One of the arguments that Obasekera makes in this book, he says that it's very unlikely that this idea spread between these different cultures, because these different cultures are very far apart, right? And we're talking about things that happened over 1,000 years ago. There was very little communication between these cultures, so they seem to have arisen independently. Now, if these ideas arise independently, where does it come from, right? It's a fascinating question, of course. And the obvious answer would be that, well, where they come from is because it is a reality. If it is a reality, I should rather say, if it is a reality, it is quite likely that people anywhere around the world, in any kind of culture, sometimes they're able to tap into that reality. And of course, that is why if you're able to tap into that reality, then that idea can really arise anywhere, at any time, in any culture around the world. So this is kind of what this research perhaps is pointing to. It's obviously not definitive, but it points to that. And the last point here is that the belief in karma is not as widespread. The belief in karma is mostly confined to the Indian tradition and also to the Greek tradition. So that is not as widely held. And I think the reason for that is also fairly obvious. And the reason for that is that karma is a very complicated thing, and it's much more difficult. The reality of rebirth is pretty much, it's something that you can see much more, it is a much more universal thing. Whereas karma, the way it functions, is often so complicated, it can be very hard to see the connection between cause and effect. There's not really a linear sequence there. It's quite a complex thing. So it's probably something that you might expect as a consequence of the complexities of karma. But anyway, it's just fascinating to know that this idea is so widespread around the world. And I think this is, I think, an important fact to keep in mind.
When you mentioned about that people in these different cultures may get some in touch with that reality or whatever, then presumably that would be through things like, we're going to look at later on, maybe some shamanic trance states or near-death experiences and these kinds of things.
There is another, I think he is an anthropologist as well, I'm not sure exactly what his background is, maybe a psychologist, and he has argued that all the world's religions actually have arisen from near-death experiences. That's what he reckons. And he has done research into ancient scriptures around the world. There is, all the kind of most ancient cultures. Mm. And he reckons that near-death experience, it was a universal thing that happened across all these cultures as well. Okay. And then he surmises from that this is where religions originate from.
Interesting.
He's at Oxford University. He's quite
Okay. So moving along, and just some statistics, but we just saw that belief in rebirth is fairly widespread in traditional cultures around the world, but it's also fairly widespread today. And these are just to give you a rough idea of the statistics, 22% of respondents in Western Europe believe in reincarnation. According to a 2005 Gallup poll, 20% of US adults believe in reincarnation. And recent surveys by a Christian research non-profit organization, and that's interesting because they obviously would have presumably had, confirmation bias against people believing in rebirth. But nevertheless, they found that a quarter of US Christians, including 10% of born-again Christians, embrace the idea of rebirth. So this is something that we see quite commonly throughout this field, that it's often alleged by skeptics that people only believe in rebirth because it's sort of culturally conditioned and programmed and people have a confirmation bias and so on. But we will actually regularly see, not just here, but in many contexts, that in fact the opposite is true. That even in a case where there's a culture that strongly is opposed to the idea of rebirth, which of course American born-again culture is strongly opposed to the idea of rebirth, even within that culture there's still a very significant amount of people who believe in it. Again, that doesn't prove anything, but it is interesting to see how persistent that idea is. It obviously has some kind of meaning or resonance. It has there's some power to it, which is not merely the fact that it belongs to one particular religious context or another.
And not only that, what this statistic doesn't show is that percentage with actually people who believe in rebirth is not only within Christianity, it's actually across all religions. You find this in Islam, apparently, you find this in Judaism, you find this across all religions. Obviously, it's higher in some religions like Hinduism or Buddhism, where pretty much everybody believes in rebirth. Actually, not nowadays, not everybody anymore, but most people do anyway. And also among people who are not religious, right? Among atheists or agnostics. They too. There's a similar kind of percentage of people who actually believe in rebirth. So it seems to be kind of across society in a very, very broad sense.
I gave a retreat in Germany a couple of years ago, and there's about 30 or 40 people on the retreat, and most of them were all Europeans and Americans, and there was one lady there from Thailand. And this topic came up, and I asked them, who thinks that there's probably something to this idea of rebirth? And everybody put their hand up, except for the Thai lady, right? She was the only one there who didn't believe in rebirth, yeah? And to me, that's really important because, it's so often people say, oh, yes, these things are just culturally conditioned and so on, as if we're nothing other than mindless automatons who are completely incapable of questioning the ideas around us. But, of course, that's not the case. And people in every culture, every religion, every time question. And they don't just believe something because it's taught to them by their religion. Anyway, so we next move on to look at different kinds of evidence. And this is a survey of some of the main kinds of evidence that we'll be looking at in the context of karma and rebirth. First one is the evidence of authority, anecdotes, obviously the authority of the Buddha and other people who believe in rebirth. Savants, so this is people who have often children, who have extraordinary kinds of knowledge and abilities. Near-death experiences, memories, spontaneous memories, regression through hypnosis and so on, and meditation. The link between these memories and biology, and finally through looking at the how we learn language and other skills which are acquired by young children. So this is a sort of list of headings, and most of what we're going to be doing this afternoon is looking at these headings in more detail. We will be using quite a few different video clips and things like that. So that's mainly because we're a bit lazy and we'd rather just watch telly than to be doing the teaching. So so we have some of those things. But anyway, let's have our first meditation break and let's just sit for 5 minutes before we go on to the next session. Okay, so let's move on.
Okay, so this is on the first point, which was authority and also anecdotes. And of course, the main authority from a Buddhist point of view about the idea of rebirth obviously is that the Buddha said there is such a thing, right? And I think it's important people don't realize, I mean, we talked about this a little bit before, but people often don't realize how central this is to the Buddha's teachings. It's not as if this is some kind of peripheral idea that you can maybe the Buddha taught rebirth, maybe he didn't. Maybe he accepted it from the culture around him, maybe he didn't. It's absolutely crucial to the Buddha's teachings, right? And here you have Jati Pitukka, which is the first noble truth, birth is suffering. And of course the whole first noble truth, so birth is suffering. And it's important to understand that this actually means rebirth in the first noble truth. I think perhaps we spoke about this before, but remember that the purpose of the first noble truth is to end suffering. And the only kind of birth you can possibly end is future birth. And for that reason, the meaning there is obviously rebirth. You can say birth in a general sense, but it implies rebirth. And you have the second thing with the second noble truth here, yayang tanha porno bhavika. And this quite literally means that craving, tanha, that craving, which is porno bhavika. Porno means again, from puna, bhavika means to exist, so means again existence. So that craving which leads to again existence, which has to do with again existence, is what that means. So again, central, right, and it can be argued that every single of the Four Noble Truths is about rebirth. So extremely central. It's not only there, it is in many different places as well. You have the Buddha saying here, the pubbe ananusute sudamesu, in regard to things or principles not learned from another. And now we are moving on to not just the Buddha as an authority, but also to the Buddha as a witness of rebirth, right? It's not just that the Buddha says there is rebirth, he says, I have seen this for myself. So in regard to principle that I have seen, that I haven't learned from another, I declare that there is such a thing as rebirth. Again, the I arose, knowledge arose, right? These are things which actually relate specifically to the Buddha. And we see this okay, please interrupt if you want to interrupt. So the next thing then, of course, where we see this specifically, that the Buddha declares his own understanding of this, is when he goes through the three higher knowledges, right? The te, vijja in Buddhism, which is recalling your past lives, understanding essentially how the rebirth process is conditioned by karma, and finally the destruction of the defilements. And the first one of those, the Buddha says specifically, when my mind was stilled in this way, pure and bright, unblemished, free from defects, malleable, wieldy, steady, attained to imperturbability, and you will probably recognize that that is a reference to the fourth jhana state, then once you have that, I directed and inclined my mind to the knowledge and recollection of past lives. And this is a standard thing that the Buddha says throughout the suttas. I realized this. I saw this past lives, right? This is something I've seen. This is not something that I take on board because other people say so. This is my personal knowledge. And remember, this is two aspects here. One thing is that the Buddha's authority here, the Buddha says, this is the truth. But the second thing, which I think is very important here, is the fact that this is an aspect of what we call anecdotal evidence, right? In normal life, when we talk about anecdotal evidence, it's a bit like you hear a story there, you hear a story here, right? Somebody tells you, oh, I had this memory of past life, then I went to check it out, and I had this memory, I checked it with the facts, and it matched the facts, right? I had this memory of being this person with such a name, who lived in such a place, who did these kind of things, these good things, these bad things, right? And then I found out this person actually existed. And of course, the more of those facts check out, right, the more if you have a name and a place, and it becomes very unlikely after a while that that is just a product of chance. It must be a product of, of actually a real memory. So this is what we mean by anecdotal evidence. And some people have more authority, some people have less authority, but these are anecdotes. But to me, the most important of all anecdotal evidences is the fact that the Buddha said, I remember my past life. That is a similar kind of thing, right? You believe that somebody tells you this happened, and it's really a kind of anecdotal evidence in one way, topped up, of course, with the authority of the Buddha himself. In that sense, it is very important. And the only way that this works as anecdotal evidence is to, of course, to understand that the Buddha was a real historical personality, right? Just like us, he was somebody who existed at a certain time and place. He did teach these particular things. And because of that, because he is a real historical personality, and I think this is what people often have a hard time getting the mind around, but once you accept that, it becomes this type of evidence, just like you hear about it in the present day. So I think as a Buddhist, this is really, really important. The fact that the Buddha said so is actually, and specifically that he had the experience, is actually a very important aspect of this this whole issue.
Mics. We do have a mic somewhere.
Mics are coming.
In order to recollect past life, this information about past life has to be stored somewhere. Where is it stored?
No, I'm only kidding, only kidding. Actually, you back it up in the cloud. That's something that maybe is we will look at a little bit more, I think, in the next workshop. So some look at more some of the philosophical underpinnings and so on of it. But just to remark that this is one of the arguments which the skeptics use. They say, well, you might have some evidence which suggests that rebirth is there, but you don't have any mechanism to explain it, okay? But of course there are two quite different kinds of things, right? There's the knowledge that something happens and the knowledge how something happens. And you might not understand how it happens, but that doesn't prove that it didn't happen, yeah? So, anyway, probably that would lead us to a lot of very interesting and discussions, which might be better off next workshop. Yeah. Okay, so this is for our next one. We're going to look at just a few statements. We'll rush over this fairly briefly, of different philosophers and people of who are regarded as being some kind of authority over time. And as Venerable mentioned before, one of the main figures in Western philosophy, of course, is Socrates. And Socrates not only believed in rebirth, but he actually made rebirth the foundation of his entire philosophical method, something which is often, I think, sidelined or ignored in treatments of Socrates' philosophy from the Western point of view. And this was outlined most clearly in a dialogue with his called the Meno, where he's in a conversation, and this is just one of the excerpts from it, and typical Socratic style, he's in a conversation with somebody, and his main aim is to annoy all of the rich and powerful people by proving them to be complete idiots, which of course eventually got him killed. And one of the ways that he did that in this particular context was to show that an unlettered slave boy was just as capable of understanding a geometric proof as all of these kind of fancy schmancy intellectuals and things like that who thought that they were so good. And he said, well, you think you're so good, but you know, this kid can understand geometry just as well as you do. And so he led this unlettered slave boy, remember, he'd never had no education, no understanding of mathematics or anything like that. They cleared out a spot of ground and got a stick, and he got him to draw a line and drew another line, and he led him step by step through this geometric proof to show that he could understand this. And so then Socrates draws out the implication of this and saying, well, look, he obviously had this understanding, right? Socrates was drawing out this understanding, this innate knowledge of geometry from this boy. It's a conclusion which Socrates said, well, if he had this knowledge, then that true ideas had to be awakened into knowledge by putting questions to him, so his soul must always have possessed this knowledge, okay? In other words, from his past lives, he already learnt things. Now, this idea that knowledge is innate because we've learnt things from our past life is the basis of the word which we're familiar with in the West that we call education. Think about what the meaning of the word education is, right? To educate is to educe, yeah? Deuce from the root duct, right? To draw something, e out, right? To draw out. That's what education means, yeah? Education means to draw out the knowledge and capacities that are inherent in a person. And the very idea of education comes from this Socratic philosophy. That's why we have schools in every country in the world, right? Because we believe that children have knowledge and wisdom which we can draw out by stimulating them in the right way. Unfortunately, somewhere along the line that kind of got lost, and we begin to think of education as putting in rather than drawing out. I think that's maybe changing a lot. But it's almost impossible to overestimate how powerful and how influential this idea was. Very highly recommended. As always, Socrates' dialogues are extremely entertaining and thought-provoking if you get the chance to read that. In modern times, we also have here a few statements from different philosophers and scientists towards the end, and these are just some quotes that we picked up from here and there. Towards the end of her own storied life, the physicist Doris Kullmann-Wilsdorf, whose groundbreaking theories on surface physics earned her the prestigious Hain Medal from the German Society of Material Sciences, surmised that Ian Stevenson's work, which we'll be looking at more later on, had established that the statistical probability that reincarnation does in fact occur is so overwhelming that cumulative evidence is not inferior to that for most, if not all, branches of science. Okay? That's a pretty powerful statement, right? This is a prize-winning top-level physicist, and she says that the evidence for reincarnation is at least as good as the evidence for most, if not all, branches of science. Dr. Howard Leaf, Journal of Nervous and Mental Disorders, said that Ian Stevenson is either making a colossal mistake or he will be known as the Galileo of the 20th century. Again, very powerful statement. Another statement on Ian Stevenson's work, he's placed on record a large amount of data that cannot be ignored from the German Journal of the American Medical Association. From Carl Sagan, well-known scientist, astronomer and founding member of the debunking organization, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, said that at the time of writing, there are three claims in the parapsychology field which, in my opinion, deserve serious study, the third being that young children sometimes report details of previous life which, upon checking, turn out to be accurate and which they could not have known about in any other way than reincarnation. So here we have even one of the most renowned skeptics of modern times accepting that there is something to this evidence. If you're interested to review the evidence on reincarnation in more depth, we can very strongly recommend this book, Irreducible Mind, okay, which we have a copy of here. Do you want to maybe just get the book and we can show people? There are simpler books to read, but this one is very large. It's printed in extremely small font with very small margins and lots of footnotes. Okay, that's the kind of book that you want to read, isn't it? And it gathers together a huge range of evidence and research from the last 100 years and presents it with a very powerful theoretical discussion of all kinds of weird and wonderful stuff, not just rebirth, but many different kinds of unusual mental and psychological phenomena. So this is a comment as a review in the Journal of Consciousness Studies. Says only a resistant observer will remain unpersuaded that a proportion at least of all this carefully evaluated data presents a significant challenge to conventional views, and also said it's a reliable, level-headed guide, critical and scholarly in its approach to the contestable data and incisive in its observations on the current state of cognitive neuroscience. There was actually a paper published, a call for investigation into consciousness, which was published, I think, was it last year or the year before, and signed by a very large number of researchers and academics around the world who have called for more research into consciousness studies.
One of those signatories for that paper is asking for more research into consciousness.
Yeah.
He's coming to the conference in Perth.
Okay. Yeah. Which one?
Bernard Carr. He's actually an old friend of Adam Brown's from Cambridge University. Yeah. So there
you are. Very good.
Have a connection straight away. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. So that's the our discussion of authorities. Is there anything anyone would like to ask any question on that before we move on?
When the Buddha sat under the tree and looked with a clear mind, he saw many rebirths.
And
then he went on and he saw many people all having different rebirths. You know, just to have a recollection of one rebirth, I don't think is really enough.
Ah, is one enough? Well, yes, that's... I think that would vary. I mean, if you mean is that enough for understanding or for liberation? I think it depends on your personality, really. Yeah.
If you've had one, it's good enough to have had 1,000.
Right.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying.
Sure. Yep.
Bhante, previously you mentioned that, of course, in Africa and Southern America and various places, people believe in cross-cultural, it crosses the cultural boundaries.
Hmm.
So did you, in those evidence, notice that the basis of rebirth, like in Buddhism, we believe the five khandhas and then the stream of consciousness is the one that gets rebirth, reborn. So did they believe in all-controlling soul getting reborn?
Typically, there's a range of different kinds of ideas about it, but most commonly, there's some kind of soul theory.
So what their belief was that there is a soul, and that soul travels and gets reborn.
Something like that, yeah. Although it's not necessarily sort of conceived in a clear philosophical sense, right? It's more just a sort of innate belief. And some souls don't always have to be immaterial. In fact, very often souls are conceived to be some kind of material thing, an object. Yeah, so there's many, many different kinds of conceptions about how that happened, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add a comment. There's documented evidence of people having huge trauma or being put into induced comas who have come out speaking fluently in other languages.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know if that.
That's an interesting one. That's called xenoglossia. That's a good name, isn't it? Right. That's a good one. You can kind of casually drop into conversation now and then. Right. And I considered putting that in there, but there is some dispute about that. There are a number of cases which seem to be fairly well documented, but they also are somewhat disputed, and I didn't feel that the evidence around that was as strong as it is for some other things. Not to dismiss it, but yeah, that's why we didn't put it in this one. But definitely, it is very interesting. And there's cases of people basically wake up from a coma or something, and they speak Norwegian, and you're like Swedish, whatever. It's important to some people, the difference. Anyway, okay, very good. I guess if you're okay, sorry, Miri.
Yeah, will you be talking today about, when it comes to accepting authorities for rebirth, about there's something about the training of the mind, say, through meditation, which might give more credence to, say, a claim from somebody who is a very accomplished meditator because they have perhaps got rid of a lot of biases to do with a sense of self and things which might normally make the mind deluded, which might then give yet greater reason to that it's not some fanciful delusion.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that there would be I think a tendency though to accept that within any field, wouldn't there? Right. I mean, if you were say a physicist, you might be more likely to accept the authority of a physicist within your field because you know that physicists are all objective and rational and so on. If you're a philosopher, you might be more inclined to accept the thoughts of a philosopher. There's probably also a counterweight to that. You're probably also more likely to be critical of them. But yes, I do think there's something to that. And that, you know, authority obviously doesn't prove anything, but I think it's foolish to dismiss the words of wise people who have considered these important matters, right? It doesn't prove it, but it does suggest something. I think it should be taken seriously. Yeah. Okay, so let's move on. Oh, sorry, we have another question. Nick.
Who are the maybe the most foremost skeptics or authorities of the opposite opinion?
We'll be looking at skeptics later on.
Okay, great. Yep. Thank you.
We'll come back to that. Okay, so savants, young children, sometimes adults perhaps, who display extraordinary knowledge or abilities that cannot be explained by their experiences in this life. Perhaps cannot be, or maybe can be. Let's have a look at a couple of videos that will show you some of the examples of what we're talking about. This particular one is a Korean talent contest.
So. 피아노? 피아노 어디냐고? 피아노 여기 있어요. 피아노, 여기 피아노 소리나게? 이름이 뭐예요?
예은이에요.
예은이에요? 예은이는 몇 살이에요?
5살이에요.
오늘 그 스타킹에 여기 뭐하러 나왔어요?
피아노 칠 거예요.
피아노 칠 거예요? 네. 예은이 피아노 잘 쳐요?
네.
예은이 어머니하고 인터뷰를 간단하게 해보도록 하겠습니다. 어머니 안녕하세요.
안녕하세요.
예.
우리 예은이는 날 때부터 앞을 볼 수가 없거든요.
네.
그리고 저기 피아노를 한 번도 배운 적이 없어요. 네, 딱 한 번 듣고 피아노를 쳐요.
한번 음악을 들으면 그냥 그걸 그대로 소리로 표현해낼 수 있는 거예요?
예. 그러니까 가르쳐준 적이 없어요. 그리고 오늘같이 이렇게 많은 사람들 앞에서 예은이가 나오고 싶어 해가지고 스타킹이 나오게 됐어요.
시작!
피아노 이렇게 유전적으로 잘 치는 게 아닌가 싶거든요.
혹시 제가 같은 중에 비교적 좀 치시는 분이에요?
저희는 또 음악하고는 거리가 멀어요. 예은이는 그 저희가 애를 못 낳아요. 입양이 있거든요.
예은이가 언제부터 갑자기 이렇게 피아노를 치기 시작했어요?
치기 시작한 건 3살 때부터. 제가 김종환 씨의 그 사랑을 위하여인가? 그 노래를 좀 좋아해요. 이른 아침에 이렇게 불렀어요. 어느 날 그걸 치더라고요, 3살 때.
사랑을 위하여 예언을 할 수 있어요?
아니, 그러지 말고 노사연 씨의 그.
만남.
예. 한 대목 한 번만 불러요.
돌아보지 마라. 후회.
기가 막혀라.
그 재능에 소름이 끼칠 정도로 우리 많은 놀라운 여러분들도 진짜 몸이 어색할 정도로 위대한 재능을 가지고 있는 별장감을 소유합니다.
예은이 노래도 부를 줄 알아요?
네.
그러면 노래 부르면서 피아노 칠 수도 있어요?
네. 열심히 할게요.
예. 노래 제목이 뭐예요? 무슨 노래 부르고 싶어요?
당신은 사랑받게.
시작.
당신의 사랑 때문에 그 사람 맞고 있는 당신. 당신의 삶 속에서 그 사람 받고 있지요. 태초부터 시작된 하나님의 사랑을 내게
위대한 재능인데 왜 우리 많은 놀라운 여러분들이 큰 박수를 쳐주지 않나 생각을 하고 있겠지만 예언이가 이제 그 큰 소리를 듣고 이러면 굉장히 그 놀랄 수도 있고 그래서 우리 그 놀라운 여러분들이 그 놀라움을 지금 억지로 참아내고 있습니다.
좋은 선생님 만나서 예은이가 정말 크게 잘 자랄 수 있도록 그런 바람이 있어요.
자 우리 90번의 놀라운 여러분들 다섯 유예언 어린이의 이 능력 이 놀라움 어떻게 평가하시겠습니까? 자, 공개합니다. 우리 스타킹 사상 최고의 점수 아닌가? 지금까지 최고의 스타킹 스타 킹메이킹 스타킹은 5살 천재 피아니스트 천재 모차르트 유예은 어린입니다.
Any cynics among you? Yes.
Strange talents. I'm just wondering about autism.
Yeah.
And I know that there are children who can see a building and reproduce it absolutely perfectly. Or they hear a song and they can play it immediately. Mm. And that is pretty well documented in the medical history of autism. So I just have that little possibility that maybe she
Yeah, has. Yeah, of course that doesn't... That's just another data, isn't it? It doesn't explain
it.
Yeah,
but, yes, it is.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it's pretty impressive.
It's pretty amazing, yeah. So here's... I know that when you were looking at that, the main thing that you were thinking about was that she's okay, but she could play it a lot faster. And, well, here's this guy. Little Showman, that one. There's a bit more there, but I might just leave it with that one. So obviously, if any of you have ever done piano lessons, you're sort of cringing inside yourself right now. I mean, what can you say? I mean, it's interesting because sort of the contrast between the two of them. I mean, the first little girl was obviously unschooled and unlettered. I mean, she just had music sort of flowing out of her soul, right? I mean, there was no technique there. It was just in her. Was this kid? I don't know what his background is, but he's obviously highly technically proficient. To me, it doesn't have quite the same feel, right? He's more, you know, he's obviously having fun and playing around, and he's an incredible player. But it's a different kind of experience what he's doing there. But I think both cases are, you know, quite equally stunning. How does this happen? What's the reason? Well, your guess is as good as mine. Obviously, if we're looking at it from a context of rebirth, and you say, well, people can inherit different skills and so on. Perhaps there might be another explanation. I don't know. Again, like many of the things in this region, it doesn't really prove anything, but it is very, I think, very interesting and very striking. Anything to say about on the savants?
Yeah, just that I was just actually looking up on Wikipedia's savants before I came in here, and one of the interesting things it said there was that very often they have one area where they are extremely good, but their general intelligence is often below average. Often they are, you know, they might be able to kind of do the 13th root of a 20-digit number in their head in 1 minute or whatever. But when it comes to kind of ordinary things, they can't even put on their trousers or whatever. So they're very, you know, so it's not because they're extremely intelligent, it's just because they have something which is very special for one reason or whatever.
Another example of this kind of thing, the savant, is the case of Damaruan. And when we came in today, you heard the chanting of the little boy over the PA, and the chanting was from Damaruan. What we're going to do is just play a little bit of a clip from an interview which Venerable Brahmali and myself did with Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi about 6 months ago. And I should just warn you before playing this clip is that we had very serious technical problems in recording it, and what it meant was that the audio tracks were out of sync. So you'll hear Venerable Brahmali and myself laughing and responding quite inappropriately as Bhikkhu Bodhi is talking. Okay, so please just filter those bits out. The editors who did their best job to try to clean it up as best as possible. So you should be able to make sense of it. But yeah, if when you hear a few bits and pieces, then that's what's going on.
You know, if he were keeping this under wraps, then I wouldn't bring up his case. But he's lost his reticency about speaking of this. And he even tells his story over the internet, so I have no hesitation about bringing up his story. Okay, so this is at the time he was a boy, even at the age of 3, he began chanting whole suttas, fairly long suttas, in Pali. He grew up in a poor family. I think the father had either passed away early in his childhood or left the family, so there was just the mother, a sister, and him. And then the mother, I think, told an educated Sri Lankan couple living nearby about their son. She thought that he was possessed by a spirit. And the couple heard his chanting and recognized that these were Pali suttas. And then they began recording his recitation, and they recorded his recitations over the years, starting from the age of 3 up to, could be, the age of 10, 11, 12, when he started to lose that ability. And so here we have a youngster who, there's almost no other rational explanation that could be given of how he could know these suttas, you could say, okay, the skeptic says he must have listened to monks chanting them over the radio. Okay, but we could take that explanation if he were reciting the Metta Sutta,
yeah,
the Mangala Sutta, the Ratana Sutta, or maybe even the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, that would be somewhat stretching the bounds of credulity for a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old boy to be reciting the whole Dhammacakka Sutta just by listening to it.
Okay.
On the radio without any text in front of them. Okay, but a young boy, I think he was 7 or 8 years old, he chanted the entire Giri Mananda Sutta. And that is just so rarely chanted by monks on the radio. And then there's a recording of him reciting passages from the Patana, you know, the book of the book of conditional relations in the Abhidhamma. And I didn't compare his recitation with the text because he doesn't say which portion he's reciting, and the Patana is six or seven volumes of very repetitive text with just minor variations. His intonation is very different from the contemporary Sri Lankan style of chanting. Almost so just by listening you could tell that it's coming from another era, not, you know, the modern style of Sri Lankan chanting.
And even though he's so young, he's clearly not making mistakes. Right? He's reciting exactly the same way in multiple repeated passages. He's not just stumbling over things or being vague. He's distinctly articulating it in a consistent way across different passages. And some of the ones that I noticed where I couldn't find any particular text that had those readings at all. The conclusion I had was that he's using some textual recension that anyway wasn't part of the ones used for the PTS. Very remarkable.
And so he is just one the instance of one person that we happen to know about, because I was living near Kandy and he was growing up in Kandy. He couldn't do this normally. You know, if you ask him, Ruan recites such and such a text, he's not able to do it. But just occasionally, he would say to his adoptive father, what did he call him? Uncle. He called him uncle. I'm starting to remember. I'm starting to remember. Then Bertie would get the tape recorder and set it up and record his recitation.
Apologies for the quality of the audio, but hopefully that came across okay. I just wanted to spend just a couple of minutes to go over that in a little bit more detail. Prem.
A plug for the global conference on Buddhism in August. Mr. Kamaruan will be there personally, and
you have
the opportunity to question him.
Ah.
If you go to that stall and buy a ticket.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So Dhammaruan grew up in that village in Sri Lanka, and so now he's a grown man. I think he's about our age, isn't he, roughly, in his 40s, something like that. So he's quite a good Dhamma teacher, and he teaches retreats at Jhana Grove from time to time, and he'll be at the global conference. So, what I'm going to do, I'm just going to play one of his chants. This is the Dhammacakka. We're going to compare it with the Pali text. Varanasiyam viharati isi patane nikatai. Okay, so you can see that he's you know, with allowances for the quality of the audio, is recorded on a cassette tape in the 70s, but it's clearly he's reciting, you know, the same Pali text. He's not just making stuff up. But one of the interesting things is that there are some quirks in the way that he recites, which is a little bit different from the texts that we have them today. And these are not mistakes, as I mentioned in the clip, that these are, he does these consistently each time they come. You might not have noticed, but just in here when he said Panchavagiye Bhikkhu Amantesi, he actually said Panchavagiye Bhikkhu Amantesi. He actually had a short U at the end here of the bhikkhu. It's not a mistake. He's very, very precise when he enunciates his long and his short syllables. Yeah? I'll point out another one of these little variations a bit later on. Okay, so see here he missed out this phrase here, katameya dwe. So this is like the Buddha says, there are these two extremes that should be not cultivated by one gone forth. And in some versions, it just goes on to explain what those two extremes are. In the text in front of us, it says, what two? So that question is not really necessary. And in Dhamma Ruan's version, he omits that. Word was also another variant reading on the text in front of us. We have Seyatidang. Sometimes this I here is long, Seyatidang. But what Dhamma Ruan was reciting was Seyatidang, which is not a reading that I'm familiar with at all. I've looked at different texts and I've never actually come across that reading. Seyatidang. He quite distinctly enunciates them as separate words, and again he does that consistently. It's not just a mistake or tripping over it on that particular case. So you, even perhaps for me, more persuasive about the authenticity of it than those details. It's already fairly impressive that he can remember it. It's impressive that he remembers a version which is quite distinctive. But what's even more impressive to me is that he remembers it so naturally. And when he's reciting, he will always break his sentences up in a natural place. Right? This is something which is not done in modern chanting styles. Certainly in Thai chanting styles, they ignore natural breaks in sentences and language flow completely. It's a completely artificial chanting style. Sinhalese chanting style is a bit more natural. But here he's reciting it like somebody who knows the language. Occasionally he'll break something just to get a breath or something like that, but almost all the time he actually pauses at the right place in the sentence, a meaningful break in the sentence, at the end of the sentence, and it just sounds like somebody who knows what he's chanting. And to me, that's something which is, again, very, very hard to explain in any other way. I don't know if you have any other thoughts about his Pali or... Yeah?
Yeah, and also the obscurity of some of the text.
Yes, yeah. As Bhikkhu Bodhi pointed out, here, this particular text is quite a common one, but there are actually only a few of his recordings which are commonly available. Many more have been made, and in some of those ones which are less widely available, he was reciting extremely long and complicated texts, sometimes very several hours long. Texts like Mahasatipatthana Sutra takes about 3 hours to recite, or passages from the Patthana, again, which can take several hours to recite. So, these are things, again, which they're not part of a normal sort of daily chanting schedule or anything which could be picked up casually. They're not even things that, I mean, hardly any monks know those things, yeah. Hardly any monks actually read them, much less know them to chant them, yeah. Yes, Ananda.
Thanks, Bhante. Just a comment, because mention that for those friends here who are not familiar with these two languages, Sinhalese and Pali are two distinctly different languages, and he's a Sinhalese like me, and from Sri Lanka. And just to also say that at school, from about year 4 till about year 8, we had to learn to chant some of these. Not these, but simplest ones like
Buddhang Saranangachami or something.
Like also Mangala Sutra. But we had to by heart it. Even then we missed it. But this is a very complex and complicated sutra at the age of 3. So Pali is not the spoken language in Sri Lanka. And it's an ancient language. So it's remarkable, and then this is unbelievable. So that's what I wanted to add. So we struggle to recite these simpler sutras like even Mangala Sutra or Atana Sutra. We struggled after by hearting, but this is unbelievable.
One of the things that Bhikkhu Bodhi mentioned, interesting detail, was that his parents didn't even recognize that it was Pali. Yeah, only when they played it to a more educated couple who actually knew something about more about Buddhism. His parents thought he was possessed by a demon and was just blabbering in tongues. Yeah. So...
Did you understand what he was singing?
Sorry?
Did you understand what he was...
Did he understand? Did he understand? I'm not sure. I don't think so, but... have you heard that? We'll have to ask him at the conference.
And have we been able to trace which monk he was in a previous life? Because the style of singing is quite old, to my understanding.
Yeah, it's very different from any contemporary style.
Yeah.
We don't know that much about chanting styles of the past, but from what little I know, it sounds to me like, again, like exactly how I would have thought it would be chanting, much more melodic than we chant these days, and I think that's how it would have been chanted. I have heard rumours, and I haven't heard this from him himself, but I've heard rumours that he remembered a past life as a monk as a student of Buddhaghosa. So that would have been about 1500 years ago. Whether that's correct or not, I can't confirm, but that's the rumour that I've heard. Okay, so thank you so much for confirming that, yes.
So there's an MP3 of his talking about his personal story, and in his own words, he actually said that he remember as a student of Buddhaghosa, and he was one of the reciter.
Can you remember? Did he talk about any details of what it was like then? I mean, what was Buddhaghosa like as a teacher?
We would have to ask him in the conference.
I mean, you could get all the gossip, couldn't you? All the down and dirty about what it actually was like in those days, right? Yeah, that would be very interesting. Okay. The question was answered, all right. Okay, very good. Yeah?
Can I actually ask a question? It's about kids who actually, not musically or are trained or this sort of thing, but they are actually, if use a psychologist's way of testing them in terms of IQ, high IQ type of kids, what do you make of them? Are they would that be a sort of a rebirth type of thing that's entrenched in their soul, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that generally speaking, that the qualities that a person has in this life come from a number of different factors. And some of those factors would be genetic, some of them may be from karma, some of them may be from upbringing, and I think all of those things interact.
What I was thinking is like kids like 2 or 3 years old, given an IQ test, yep. And it's got really high in IQ tests.
Yeah.
In that sense.
Again, I think that all of those things are interacting. So yes, I would think that karma plays an influence, but genetics also plays an influence, and upbringing also plays an influence, even at the age of 2 or 3. Yeah. It's difficult to isolate these things. There was one case study I read a number of years ago. We should have actually brought that along, but the study done in Italy on prenatal behaviour of identical twins. Okay, so this is identical twins in the mother's womb, and they did behavioural studies of them, and they found out that they actually are quite different. Right? So you might have a mother who's pregnant; she has two little children in a womb, identical twins, so they're genetically the same, same environment, same context, and yet one of them might be more active than the other one, tends to move and kick more than the other one, for example. And when they're grown up, what she found was that those traits tended to persist. So the child who tended to kick more in the womb perhaps became more extroverted and more active, and the other one became more introverted. Might be just one example of how they tested it. But they did so that what there does seem to be, there was an interesting study that seemed to isolate as far as possible those characteristics. They're genetically identical, the environment's identical, and yet there is still a difference in behaviour. So there's obviously something else which is influencing the behaviour there.
Is there any known history of identical twins sharing a past life as a single person?
Oh, I've never heard of one. That would be interesting, though. Have you ever heard anything like that? I've never heard any stories of anybody sharing past lives. Not to say it doesn't happen.
I think there might be some stories about that.
There might have been one of the ones that Jim Tucker discussed. There might be some cases of people who are sharing some memories. We might have a look, check that up later, yeah. We don't have any at our fingertips, yeah. But that's an interesting one. If that does happen, then what's going on there, right? So, yeah, not quite sure. All right. So it's pretty much up to 2 o'clock already, so I think we're probably time for our first break. So why don't we have our first tea break? And now when are they starting the committee meeting?
That's going on already.
Yeah, committee meeting is on now. So look, let's just see what's happening with the break. Ideally, there will be tea and bickies, in theory. Okay, so we're all good. Okay, so let's have a break. I think back at, 2:30? Is that the break? It's half an hour break?
Yeah, okay.
Yep. 2:30, see you back here.